If you're looking for a podcast to give you heartwarming, rib-sticking recipes for old favorites like beef stew, apple pie, and my personal favorite, meatloaf.
Yeah? That sounds like a great podcast. Uh-huh. Where do we find that?
Not here.
Not here, no.
Because this is not that podcast.
Although your meatloaf is always delicious. It's never the same twice, but it's always delicious.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. But again, this is not that podcast. No. This is, however, comedy.
Tragedy.
Marriage. Welcome to Comedy Tragedy Marriage, a podcast where a longtime married couple takes turns each episode selecting a movie, TV show, or documentary to watch. We watch it together, then we sit down and discuss why we liked it, loved it, or loathed it, and share that discussion with you. I am Stan the Movie Man. I occasionally review films at stanthemovieman.com. You can follow me on Twitter or X or Zitter or X-Twit or whatever you want to call it.
Zitter is good.
I liked it. You can follow me there at Movie Man Stan. You can follow the podcast at CT Marriage. You can also follow me on Blue Sky, also at Spoutable, as well as Threads, all at Stan the Movie Man. If you have a question that you would like to submit to us, something longer form than you can post on one of those platforms, then by all means, you can send that to us via email. You can also send us a suggestion for a movie you'd like us to watch. Just tell us what the name of the movie is and why you think we should watch it. Send that to comedytragedymarriage@gmail.com. You can also send that to us via a voice message by clicking the link in the description of this episode. Joining me, as always, is my partner through life, my other half.
Maud, the movie broad. I know, that's boring, but it is what it is.
Okay. Well, this week it was my turn.
Oh, I'm Maud the Held Over Broad. Duh.
Okay, okay, yeah.
Stupid me.
No, well, no. No, you're not stupid. This week it was my choice, and I had meant to go see this movie when it was in theaters, and it may be playing in limited release in some theaters as the Academy Awards are getting closer, but it's not playing, you know, widely right now. Not that it played that widely to start with. But this week we are talking about the 2023 American comedy drama, dramedy, if you will, The Holdovers, that stars Paul Giamatti, Divine Joy Brown, Dominic Sessa, and more. It is the story of a boys' private prep school in New England. It follows one particular teacher, a guy named Paul Hunnam. He teaches ancient civilizations, and he is greatly disliked by all of his students because he is a tough teacher. Most of these guys were born on third base and believe they hit a triple. They feel like they deserve to get a passing grade, even if they don't do the work. He vehemently disagrees. He has one particular, young student, a kid named
Tully. Angus Tully,
played by Dominic Sessa, who is actually a decent student on his last test, where most of the other students fail or at the very least get low C's. He got a B+ in the ancient civilizations class. But he is a troublemaker. He's been kicked out of numerous high schools, and his mom and his stepfather are going to, if he gets kicked out of this one, put him into a military academy.
Ooh, which at the end of 1970 is not where you want to be.
Exactly, because at the, of course, that is the height of America's involvement in the Vietnam War. Now, Paul Giamatti plays Paul Hunnam, the teacher, and he has this his students refer to him as wall-eyed because he has his one eye that goes in a different direction.
Sometimes referred to as lazy eye.
Yes. You know, he's constantly talked ugly about behind his back. He's difficult to work with the school director. They want him to, in the past, they had wanted him to pass like a senator's son, give him a passing grade, a C-, but he refused. He failed the senator's son, and that caused some angry phone calls, I'm sure.
Senator and huge donor.
Yes, that was the biggest problem.
Because it's a very prissy boys boarding school.
Yes.
The campus is very picturesque.
Very
it's lovely.
Yes.
We see in an early scene in the film, the boys are forced to go to chapel, and there's a priest or a pastor there in full clerical robe and regalia, and it's very... It's a very fancy rich boy place.
Now, as the movie starts, they are just about to go on Christmas break. And Angus is going to go with his mother and stepfather to St. Kitts to go on a tropical vacation. However, he finds out right before they're supposed to go that they... are not going. Turns out that his mother and stepfather are going to take a trip for themselves, a honeymoon, and that he's not going. He's going to have to stay at the school, joining a few other students who are holdovers, hence the title of the movie, who for various reasons will not be going home for the holidays. Now, originally, Paul Hunnam is not supposed to be the teacher who stays with the students, but through some sneaky machinations by the teacher who was supposed to stay with the students, it turns out Paul Hunnam gets to be the teacher who has to spend the holidays with these, I believe it's five students who do not want to be there. And made even, compounded even more so by the fact that the father of one of the students shows up in his helicopter because the company that he runs is a helicopter company.
Super fancy.
Yes, and he shows up and he agrees to take all the boys out west to go skiing, but unfortunately they can't get a hold of Angus's mom or stepfather, and Angus ends up having to stay at the school with Paul Hunnam, along with Mary Lamb, who is the head cook at the school, who is also staying over the holiday. Mary Lamb's played by Joy Rudolph. And she is, each of these characters is going through a personal crisis. Some of them have been going through it longer than others. Some of them we don't learn about until later. We learn about Mary Lamb's pretty early. Her son, who was a student at the school that is called Barton, and he went there because she worked there. Being an African-American young man, he wound up going to Vietnam, even though most of the other white kids who go to Barton don't go to Vietnam because their parents are rich and they can buy them out of Selective Service. He has died in Vietnam, and she is grieving the loss of her only son, only child, in that conflict. Meanwhile, Angus is grieving the loss of his father, who we don't get the details of until very late in the film.
He's just gone.
Yeah, he's
out of the picture.
We hear early on that he's dead.
Yeah.
And Paul Hunnam has a whole history of heartache and stuff that is that is beyond his control, both genetic and just sheer bad luck.
Genetic and circumstantial, I would say.
All of these three people are forced to be together for the holiday. They don't want to be with each other. They really don't want to be with anyone, with the possible exception of Angus. He would rather be in St. Kitts with his mom. Well, actually, he doesn't really want to be with his stepdad because his stepdad's kind of a jerk.
But he'd like to be with some family.
Yes, he'd like to be with family. But, you know, he's got this... They all have this festering pain that, for the most part, none of them are dealing with. But that comes out, and they have no choice but to deal with over the course of the film. Part of what Angus's issues are in school is this pain that comes out through his acting up in school. He's been accused of blowing up a toilet in the school. He's constantly back talking, and other things. Mr. Hunnam is constantly bucking authority, the authority of the leadership of the school, and refusing to play by their rules and refusing to cut any of the kids any slack.
He's tilting at intellectual windmills.
Yes.
Which is unfortunate because he's curmudgeonly, but he's lovable in his curmudgeonliness.
In a way, yes, he is, and he becomes more lovable over the course of the film. Mary Lamb, on the other hand, I think just keeps people at arm's length because she doesn't want to be hurt anymore.
Well, yeah, if you let them close enough, they'll hurt you.
They'll either leave you or they'll die.
Or they will pity you because your kid died. And I think
that hurts.
As a strong African-American woman who has made her way...
pretty much by herself.
Yeah. And made a way for her kid, who obviously was smart.
Mm-hmm.
I think she said that he had scholarship offers to places, but there still wasn't enough money.
Oh yeah,
to send him, and that's how he ended up being drafted. But she has been a smart, tough woman who has made her way on her own, and you know, you insulate yourself, and she appears to be a woman who has insulated herself. And again, in America in 1970, it wasn't just the height of the Vietnam War. There was still a whole lot of very intense racial conflict going on and a lot of cultural unrest. And so as an African American, you have to wear your armor because it's not safe if you don't. So you don't let people close.
That was not at all explored in the movie.
No, it could have been, but I don't know really if we had room for it.
Well, I was a little surprised. There's a scene in an upscale restaurant, and where Mary comes in, and nobody bats an eye. Now, this was in a large city, I believe Boston, so maybe in that instance, it wasn't anything unusual, or maybe just for the story, nobody was going to say anything, because that's not this kind of, that wasn't that kind of story.
That wasn't the crux of what was being explored.
But, so, that's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
Sorry,
squirrel.
Yeah. So, I wanted to see this when it was in theater, just never got around to it. And those dadgone round to it's, they're often hard to find. And then it popped up almost immediately on Peacock, and, which is where we watched it and streamed it. Of course, if you don't have Peacock, you can, rent it on whatever platform, or buy it. But, it was my choice for this week. And it is that this makes it the fifth film nominated for Best Picture that of the 10 that I have seen this year. Which is better than my average, because normally I don't see all of them or get close to seeing all of them. But. Anyway, the film is about a family that doesn't want to be a family at first, and then begrudgingly accepts that they are a family over the course of the film. And it's sweet and funny and sort of painful to watch at times. It's also sort of cringy. It's like, oh, don't do that. You know you don't want to do that, but you're gonna do that, aren't you? Yeah, they do that. It has so many of these aspects of really great films, and the fact that it is directed by Alexander Payne, that doesn't hurt anything. And also the fact that they played in so heavily to the fact that it's set in 1970, even creating throwback logos for the various film companies, even creating old-looking logos for film companies that didn't exist in 1970.
Yeah, the opening tags of all the production companies and houses and stuff that made it. That was very cool touch, I thought.
Yeah, it's a very sweet film that, and you kind of know that that's how it's going to wind up, you know, right off the bat, because I don't think anybody could be that big a jerk as Paul Giamatti's character is from the beginning to the end. Although he does still retain a fair amount of that throughout the film, even towards the end. But it's a film that, you know, is heartwarming and fun and sweet. And I just love the heck out of The Holdovers.
No kidding.
Kid you tell?
Surprise. Yes. Quelle surprise, as they say.
Yeah.
For me, it was a coming-of-age tale of all three of these main characters in different ways, Mary's coming of age, we see the catalyst for that. We learn about that very early on. She is mourning the loss of her son, and that is a grief passage that I would imagine, like any other grief passage of an intimate relative, is going to grow you up quick in a lot of ways. And so we see that pivotal passage for her play out, particularly at a holiday party where she, okay, Mary likes her alcohol, as does Professor Hunnam. And we see them, we see the two of them on a couch watching TV, enjoying their alcohol together, which was a very sweet, funny moment. We see Mary when she has had too much at this holiday party, and she has a moment of meltdown,
Yeah,
and
she's mad.
was she mad? Yes. And she, we see her sort of turn a little bit from her overindulgence in her alcohol. Obviously, Angus Tully comes of age in ways that we expect a senior and high school boy to come of age and not, because there are some things that we learn about his family that we are not privy to in the beginning, so that's a layer that gets peeled away. And it's a poignant and very sad situation ultimately. Professor Hunnam comes of age in a moment of magnanimous beauty toward the end of the film that is completely unexpected and glorious. And, I mean, he probably remains a little curmudgeonly little troll, but he does a thing that one would never have thought in his character for him to do. And it's lovely. And so there's a coming of age aspect to each of these three main characters that is lovely and written and portrayed beautifully by each character. If I'm not mistaken, in the opening credits, the actor Dominic Sessa, who plays Angus Tully, is introducing Dominic Sessa. So this appears to be his first film role. Now, I don't know. I haven't looked up enough or
It
done
is. It's
research.
his first. If it's his
Has he been
first
on
movie,
stage? Do we
I
know?
did not look him up, but I
Look him
can
up
real quick.
right quick while I ramble. You check the Google or the whatever.
Okay.
He's a weird looking kid. He has a face that is it's interesting. He's sort of pale and pasty and looks perpetually exhausted. He's got these hangdog, world-weary eyes that look like they belong to somebody twice or three times his age. So he's a face to watch out for. Other interesting faces are that of Paul Giamatti, who is not leading man handsome. He is not your conventional leading man, Cary Grant, Harrison Ford, conventionally beautiful kind of actor. He first came to my attention in a prominent way in 2004's film Sideways, which was a glorious, sweet, again, little movie, and got him a lot of press and a lot of notoriety. Sandra Oh was also in Sideways. It was a great little film. Another not blockbuster, shall we say. Did you find Dominic Sessa?
I did.
Has he been on
And
stage?
no.
Oh, he's never been
Well, I mean,
anywhere.
he has been, but in high school productions.
Oh, so like not on the stage.
Yes. Sessa was discovered by casting director Susan Shopmaker, who offered Deerfield Academy students a chance to audition for The Holdovers, since the film was using the academy as a shooting location. Sessa was selected among 12 students who auditioned for the role. In September 2023, Sessa was listed as one of Variety's 10 actors to watch for 2023.
I get that.
He will next appear in Tow, starring Stephanie Lang, directed by Stephanie Lang and starring Rose Byrne.
Well, okay then.
He's
one to watch.
He was active in the school's Deerfield Academy in Deerfield, Massachusetts. He was active in the school's theater program, acting in the plays Antigone and Rumors, and directing an excerpt from No Exit. As of September 2023, Sessa was a student at the Carnegie Mellon School of Drama.
Look at
that. Until now, he's a big-time movie star actor type.
But again, unless they do a lot to him with makeup and changing his hair and stuff, he's not a conventionally beautiful face necessarily to look at. But
no.
It's a very interesting and very expressive face.
He may work forever as a character actor.
Like Paul Giamatti.
Paul Giamatti's first film role was it just flew out of my head.
Okay, let me check my Google.
The movie about the radio shock jock, Private Parts.
Yeah,
he played Pig Vomit in Private Parts. And then from that, he has built what could only be described as a pretty stellar career.
Often in supporting roles. He had supporting roles in My Best Friend's Wedding, Saving Private Ryan, Man on the Moon. He had leading roles that he got good press for. In American Splendor, Sideways, Win Win, and Private Life, he also played John Adams in the HBO miniseries John Adams.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think he won an Emmy for that, didn't he?
Won several awards, including a Primetime Emmy and a Golden Globe.
All right, then.
He's been nominated for 2 Oscars, and he's one of those faces. You see him and it's like, oh, I know that guy.
Yes.
But he's also, more than just I know that guy now because he's...
Oh, yeah.
So you love the heck out of this film.
Yes.
I also love the heck out of this film. I think that it's lovely. Visually, it's beautiful. It's very scenic. The surroundings are beautiful. It's winter in, New England, and it's cold, and there's snow, and it's gorgeous. Good writing, excellent writing, excellent acting, just, 11-T student affairs buildings from me.
Well, I give it 5 stars. It is certainly worth your time.
Oh, gosh, yes.
There was one thing I noticed about the film is it feels like it's, at least in a traditional narrative way, it feels like it's coming to an end on at least 2, possibly 3 occasions. It feels like it's wrapping up. And then there's more of it.
I didn't catch that.
Well,
so I don't know where you're talking about.
Well, and I couldn't tell you specifically which...
Which
moments I was considering an ending or it was wrapping up. It felt like at times it was coming to an end and then there'd be a new section that was starting up. But I mean, that's not a complaint. It just felt like it was coming to an end.
And then it's like, but wait, there's more.
Yes. The movie had a 97 on Rotten Tomatoes.
Holy crap.
And an 82 on Metacritic. And granted, this was a limited release film.
Yeah.
But it made $20 million in the United States and almost $23 million in the rest of the world for a worldwide total of $42.9 million. I can't imagine.
What was the budget?
It's not listed on the wiki.
Okay.
So I can't imagine, though, it was a whole lot. You know, the biggest name in here was Giamatti, and he's not a $20 million film actor. So, you know, I'm sure it was profitable. But, it's, I think, well worth your time if you find it somewhere in maybe an art house doing a Oscars retrospective. For this year's Best Picture nominees, by all means, go see it.
Yeah.
But if not, and you have Peacock, you can watch it on there. All you got to do is watch like 2.5 minutes of commercials, and then you get the whole thing uninterrupted.
Yeah.
The Holdovers. It is streaming on Peacock. So give it a shot. We both recommend it.
Oh, yeah.
What have you been reading, watching, all that jazz?
Okay, so not really watching a whole lot of anything. I did watch a little Hallmark movie called A Nashville Legacy, and it was fine. Not terribly, you know, it was kind of predictable and tied things up kind of very neatly and very quickly. But yeah, that was okay, and it would be worth your time if you know, are of a mind and of a mood. I haven't really watched much of anything. I've been streaming episodes of Designing Women in Order on Hulu. That has been nostalgic comfort food for my brain, and it's making me very happy. And I have, it is the season of Lent for those of faith who observe such, and I am of faith to observe such, and so part of my Lenten practice this year is revisiting a book that I've read probably 3 or 4 times previously. It's very old, and it's by John Bunyan called The Pilgrim's Progress. It is an Old English allegory written during Bunyan's time in prison, and it tells the story of various characters. The main character's name is Christian, and Christian is making his progress to Mount Zion. And, you know, it's an allegory for living a life of faith and eventually making your way to heaven. So, but it's a lovely book. It, again, as I said, it's an allegory, so it's a bit of a tale. And one has to be able or willing to wrap their heads around reading in Old English. But once you kind of get the hang of that again, it's lovely writing and lovely storytelling. And there's a lot of little excerpts of poetry, rhyming poetry, that Bunyan starts the book with an extended passage of rhyming poetry, and then inserts other little passages throughout the remainder of the book, and his poetic skills are just lovely. So it's a book that has been meaningful and you know, brought joy to me, and has been bringing joy to, you know, generations and generations of readers for 200-300 years. So, you know, I recommend. So that's basically, and I'm still watching The Way Home on, it's a Hallmark thing. I'm streaming it the next day on Peacock, and it's just, the time travel just becomes more and more intricate and twisty, and there's always something surprising in each episode, and I just love it, love it, love it. So, that's me. Otherwise, anything I've watched has pretty much been with you.
Okay. We did finally wrap up that,
Manson thing.
Actually, I don't think we have finished the Manson thing.
I don't think we're done with Manson.
No, we finished the No One Saw a Thing about the bully in that little town in Missouri.
Skidmore, Missouri.
Who was murdered by several people, or murdered by people in the town, but 20 to 50 people, depending on who you listen to, witnessed the murder.
But nobody saw
it. But nobody saw anything, and nobody has come forward to, you know, so that they could press charges.
The whole town murdered him.
Yes. Now, I like this documentary series. It's like 6 episodes, but they kind of stretch the effect of this murder and its effect on the town in that they are applying how the sins of the father have, you know, in a broader sense, affected the sins of the sons, that multi-generationally. That is, there are crimes, murders, disappearances that they seem to be implying are due to this original murder. And
you don't buy the connection?
No, I don't. Especially since at least 2 of them are drug related. And the other one, it was an abusive spouse. A third one, rather, was an abusive spouse. And one kid drowned under a bridge in a river. I don't see how the... What was it? His name was Kenrex McElroy?
Yeah.
I don't see how his murder brought methamphetamine to the town 20, 30 years later. And how they can connect... It's like bad mojo or bad karma. The entire country, especially small towns, were inundated with drugs at that time. Around here,
Lord,
we've had, you know, whether it was methamphetamine or the opioid crisis,
crack.
Or crack or anything else, it's was
everywhere.
A problem everywhere. And for this documentary to claim that somehow the town murdering, Kenrex McElroy was somehow that bad mojo oozed through the generations and was responsible for these other deaths and disappearances is like, no, it's not. It's the meth.
Well, and one of the subsequent murders that they talked about, the really, really violent one.
Yeah. Oh,
I don't
yeah.
want to spoil anything. That needs to be its own docuseries.
Well, I think it has been.
That's a fascinating and gruesome case.
And that the problem, the reason for that murder was the internet.
Ugh.
Which, you know.
Talk about some bad mojo.
Yeah. But again, nothing to do with Kenrex McElroy or his murder.
That was a stretch.
They're reaching for a reason for these murders happening in this little town, and it is a little town. I think it has actually shrunk since the murder of Kenrex
McElroy. Well, yeah, they
keep
killing people.
Well, that's yeah.
Sorry, that was flippant. Yeah. Duh.
Well, but also there's no industry there. There are no jobs there except, you know, minimum wage service jobs.
It's a dying service belt hole.
Yes, unless you own a farm, and then you better own a farm that is connected to, you know, big factory farming. Otherwise, you're probably going broke too.
Yeah.
You know, it's the town is slowly drying up.
Yeah.
And
which happens to small towns across this country every day.
Sadly so.
Yeah.
And none of that has anything to do with a bunch of guys and women getting together at a town meeting
and deciding
to kill the town bully. Now, should they have done that? No, they shouldn't have done that, allegedly. But They did, allegedly.
And alleged, well, because allegedly due process did not work in his case.
Never did, yeah. Allegedly. He had been charged with numerous crimes, but had never paid any price for them. He had been charged, you'd have to watch it. There's so much wrong in this town.
Yeah.
Maybe
there is bad juju happening there. They could be like along a fault line that's like connected to a hell vortex with some kind of,
devil that's
people,
what it is.
Devil the, drug people.
The pull of the full moon is stronger there, and it's sucking all their fluids
out.
Okay,
I was
something.
Being facetious. You brought the full moon into this.
So, anyway, it's called No One Saw a Thing. It's on MGM Plus, and
basically worth the watch.
It is, but they undercut the whole seriousness of it with this connecting the things that happened in the future from Ken Rex's murder to his murder when there's no connection at all.
You take Dolores Umbridge at this.
Yes, the evil teacher in the Harry Potter series, I do take Dolores Umbridge.
That's probably why they gave her that name.
I guess so. Yeah. By the way, going back a little bit, the 10 movies, and actually I've seen 6 of them now.
Oh, okay.
The 10 movies that have been nominated for Best Picture for this year's Academy Awards, The Holdovers, American Fiction, The Zone of Interest, which is, I believe, a German movie. But I would like to see it because it's about the commander and his family of Auschwitz and how their little world where they lived was so different from the people that he was overseeing. Barbie. Oppenheimer. Definitely going to win. Poor Things, which I loved. I thought it was a very entertaining film. Past Lives. Anatomy of a Fall. Also saw that. Maestro, which you and I watched.
Mm-hmm.
And Killers of the Flower Moon. So that's your 10 nominated films for this year. I've seen Holdovers, Barbie, Oppenheimer, Poor Things, Anatomy of a Fall, and Maestro. So I'm actually ahead of where I usually am for that kind of stuff.
Cool.
And if I can, and I think Zone of Interest is still playing in our local art house theater, I would like to try to get to see that.
Yeah, that sounds intriguing.
Yeah, and actually,
sad and, you know, heavy.
The lead actress from Anatomy of a Fall is in
Zone of Interest.
Is in Zone of Interest.
Cool.
So I would be interested in seeing that.
Okay.
I watched on, because as we're recording this coming weekend, the movie Dune Part 2 will, come to theaters.
Oh.
And, it is a giant sprawling sci-fi fantasy extravaganza, of course, based on the book by Frank Herbert, and back in the 70s, before Star Wars, an effort was made to make Dune that failed due to lack of financing. And a documentary was made about that effort called Hodorowsky's Dune. Hodorowsky is a Mexican film director who made some very weird art house films that often starred himself, that he also directed, and they were experimental and often were considered obscene or were just considered so weird that nobody got them, or in some cases were considered brilliant and were you know, just praised as an artistic achievement. Well, the rights to Dune became available, and he had never read the book, and somebody, his producing partner, said, "What movie do you want to make next?" And he said, "I want to make Dune," even though he had never read it. And they were able to get the rights, which I think whoever sold him the rights said, "Yeah, they'll never make this movie." So he got a bunch of great artists from the world of comics, and graphic novels. He had H.R. Giger, who was the guy behind the designs in Alien. He had a bunch of rock bands who were going to do the music for the various worlds and characters. And he had Mick Jagger, who was going to play the character that Sting eventually played in the one version of Dune we got. He had Salvador Dali was going to play the Emperor of the Universe.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
cool.
He had, he had, oh, and he had David Carradine was going to play, Duke Leto Atreides. And his son was going to play, the young boy who is the focus of the film. Hodorowski's son. He was 12 at the time. And it tells a story about all this art that was done and all these people who oftentimes he just ran into by accident. People he wanted to talk to be in the film, and he had no idea how he was going to get them. And they just happened to be like Jagger. He was at a party, and Jagger was across the room from him, and they just beelined to each other. At least that's the story he tells in the documentary. And they just handshook, and he was in the movie, or he was going to be in the movie. And all of this prep, there is a book that is probably 3 inches thick that's the storyboards and all of the artwork that they had done and the costumes and all of it. And all they needed was the money. They thought they could do it for $15 million, which in 1971 or two, whenever it was when they were going to do it, was a bunch of money. But they had Rick O'Bannon was going to do their special effects, who at the time was, you know, a big name in special effects. Now, it might have looked kind of cheap for the, you know, compared to now, but it would have been Star Wars-like at the time.
Yeah, groundbreaking for its age.
Yeah. And all they needed was the money. And they had $10 million of the $15 million. And they just needed one of the big studios to kick in the rest. And they couldn't find anybody.
Oh, man.
And it fell apart. So all we have is this giant book, of which there are not many copies. Hodorowski's got one, of course, and they produced enough to give to every major studio that they were trying to sell it to. So there are some out there, but it's not, I don't believe you can just like order it or find it on eBay.
It doesn't sound like that kind of, you know, volume of, it sounds like a
It's
treasure.
It's a coffee table book. You would have to reinforce your coffee table to set it on.
Yeah.
But I would kill to have one. It looks beautiful. And the concepts, he was going to change the ending significantly because he was anyway, you can watch the documentary. But he was gonna change the ending a lot. But as he explained it, that kind of makes sense. So, you know, it's you can probably rent it or buy it on all the platforms, but it is streaming on HBO Max or Max now. So it's called Jodorowsky's Dune, JODOROWSKI' Dune. And it is fascinating. This guy is insane. But he's a fun insane. And I wish he had had a chance to make it, because maybe, and even though I like David Lynch's Dune, it's crap.
Okay. Tell us how you really feel.
It's crap.
Okay. All right.
But I enjoy it. It's enjoyable crap.
Sometimes crap is what we crave.
And to be honest, I found Dune Part 1 to be quite dull. The Denis Villeneuve, or however you pronounce his name. I found it boring. Because all the good stuff is going to happen in Part 2. I mean, artistically, it's beautiful. It's technically well done. But it's dull. And I'm looking forward to Part 2. So, anywho's.
Okay, we'll see.
What could have been?
Yeah.
With this version, this vision, this LSD inspired trip of a movie that could have been.
Yeah.
It is a sin we do not have this movie.
It's making me want to see the documentary.
Well, I'll happily watch it with you again. It is just amazing. This crazy man who got as close as he did to making this movie. So, Jodorowsky's Dune, it's on Max. I highly recommend you watch it. It is fantastic. All right, that's it for me. You got anything else?
I don't. Next week is my turn. I have no idea what we're going to watch. It's just, you know, we never know with me.
That's true. It's always a mystery.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for listening to this episode of Comedy Tragedy Marriage. We appreciate it. If you would be so kind as to give us a like, rate, and review on the podcast platform of your choice. But if you would do that on Spotify, that helps us out the most. If you would like to send us a question, you can do so via email. You can also send us a suggestion for something for us to watch. Tell us what it is you want us to watch and why you think we should watch it. Send it to comedytragedymarriage@gmail.com. You can also send us a voice message by clicking the link in the description of this episode. I'm Stan the Movie Man. That is my other half, Maud the Movie Broad.
Love you.
Love you too. And until next time.
Later.